From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
With all the glitz and the glamour comes a lot of sacrifice and hard work. People think that it's just, you know, the champagne, but it's not.
Hard work can bring you wonderful things.
When I saw the first month of $20,000 or $25,000, I literally like fell to my knees. It was a great moment. I recognized that making that money was real freedom.
But it can also have vicious side effects.
I watched three people absolutely fall over dead, heart attack or whatever. I've seen grown men sobbing.
Today is all about workaholics, the long hours, the stresses, and the sacrifices. From celebrity assistants to a commodities trader to the activists who brought street smarts to the world of journalism. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. Now, you might be hearing this podcast on your smartphone or your computer, things that most of us, including the workaholics that we're talking about today, can't even imagine living without. Being connected to a screen all day is the new norm. So what is all this screen time actually doing to us? NPR's Guy Raz and the team at the TED Radio Hour are asking those same questions in a special two-part episode all about our relationships with our screens, how they're changing the way we interact with others, and how they'll be shaping our future. Listen to Screen Time on the TED Radio Hour beginning September 11th. Find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. So to start off today's show, I'm joined in the studio by one of our producers, Antonia Cerejido. Hey, Antonia.
Hey, Maria.
So, Antonia, you actually were in Michigan at the beginning of the summer.
Yeah, I was part of this radio workshop at Interlochen, Michigan. Shout out to Transom and Interlochen Public Radio.
And Interlochen is a small town, right?
Yeah, so Interlochen is gorgeous, and it has this like very famous school/camp where people go and they learn about music, and there's lots of arts, and it's really, really beautiful and bucolic. Outside of the arts camp, it's this small rural community. And I looked up the demographics, and it's something like 97% white and only 1% Latino. So I became very curious about this 1% that's Latino. Who in Interlochen is Latino? And I went to TC Latino Grocery, which is a grocery store that sells products from Latin America. And I met the owner, Adolfo Mendez. On top of the store, he also owns two taquerias in the area.
I had two taquerias, and I had one store with a meat market, and I don't know next year. Maybe you come in next year, I don't know what you see. Hopefully, in the future, you see that one is expanded, it's more big.
Yeah, I mean, he wants to keep growing the store.
Does the 1% of Latinos actually come to TC Latino Groceries?
So I feel like I saw all of them. But when I was actually in the store, it was mostly white customers.
Interesting.
Yeah. Adolfo is incredibly hardworking. He's constantly running between the three businesses from the moment he gets up to when he goes to sleep. I mean, the guy just doesn't stop. And if he ever does have free time, he'll do things like go to Walmart and study how they've laid out their aisles. But the reason Adolfo opened the store is because he noticed something missing from those aisles. He couldn't find ingredients to make his favorite foods, things like mole.
Normally, when I'm looking for my produce to celebrate a special party, example, I want to make a mole that's traditional in Mexico. We don't find the ingredients here in this area.
I mean, not just anybody makes mole.
Or makes a career out of it. Adolfo moved to Traverse City, just north of Interlochen, from Veracruz, Mexico, over a decade ago.
So how does he end up in Interlochen?
He was a businessman back in Mexico, and he had a friend that was visiting from Michigan. And the friend was like, you know what, you should really check it out.
When he told me about Michigan, I started to check in the computer. Okay, Michigan, where they are, Michigan. And it looks beautiful and everything. I said, maybe I'm planning to take my vacation and go to Michigan.
And while he was at a casino in Michigan, he met someone, the woman who would become his wife.
In the casino, nobody speaks Spanish. And I find in the restaurant, now my wife, Sandra Rios. And I take the number, she take my number, and blah, blah, blah.
How did you know that she was the one?
Well, that one, it is a good question, but you never know. She's a very, very, she's a hard worker.
So he falls in love with a hard worker.
Yeah. And when Adolfo first got to Michigan, he started working hard, too. He was doing maintenance at a local company, and things were going great. He was friends with everyone at his job. He was working hard. People respected him. But then one day, somebody approached him with a concern.
They told me, you have a one problem. And I think, like, no, I don't see it, nothing. Yeah, you are a workaholic.
A workaholic.
Yes. And when the first time I listened to that word, I said, like, no idea, what is that?
This freaked him out.
So I'm scary. I go to my house and I say, like, okay, workaholic, what is that? That's cancer, that's some problem. Or I check. I'm going to my computer and what that? That one is the people, they thinking only war.
Thankfully, being a workaholic is not the same as having an actual disease. But there are still some drawbacks. Adolfo's had to give up certain things, like exercise.
Okay, you go to do something in the park, like bike or something, or swimming, or you attend your customers.
He has to choose to go to work or to do something for himself. And he tends to choose work. And that's meant he's even lost some friends.
By loss, because many times they call me and say, hey, come in here, we had a party, blah, 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 that's my birthday. Sorry, thank you, happy birthday, I can go over there. And some people now, they had a party and they not call me.
Workaholics often have to make sacrifices.
And that's what we're talking about on today's show. Latinas and Latinos who work and work hard. In fact, some say they work too hard, which is something that comes up for me a lot. That I'm one of those workingholics, like Adolfo says, because I anchor this show, but I'm also a professor at DePaul University. I write, I lecture, I also work on TV. And usually, I'll just laugh and joke and say, look, I'm a Mexican, so I never say no to work. But the truth is, I love all of my 16 jobs, passionately. Now, imagine if you're working in one of the most high-pressure environments on the planet. In Chicago, that's the Chicago Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, places where women, especially Latino women, are a pretty rare sight. But Virginia McCathy has worked a lifetime to establish herself as a respected trader. And now Adriana Cargill introduces us to her. Oh, and heads up, there's one word that we've bleeped in the middle of the story.
7,800 bid!
Is this all you want me to show? Yeah. Here it is. Oh, bearish.
Okay. Chicago's trade exchanges are a world unto themselves.
Where is it?
It's in between.
Eight bid!
Massive indoor arenas with octagonal pits built into the floor. The walls are covered in black screens with flashing red, orange, and green numbers and letters. Bells and buzzers go off every 15 minutes. There are no windows. About 20 men stand shoulder to shoulder, shouting and signaling trades.
200.
It's called open outcry, and it works kind of like an auction. Whoever cries out first gets the trade.
$9.940, put 1 by 2.
Virginia McGathy is one of the only women on the trading floor. She's dressed in the loudest jacket you can imagine. It's got red and orange flames set to a black background. She chose it to stand out from the crowd. And it works.
People were very, very foul and vulgar towards me.
Virginia's 56. When she first started on the trading floor 32 years ago, she says she lost out on a lot of business trying to compete with the men.
People saying that, why are you even here? You should be on your back somewhere. On my back that, you know, that you're a woman and you're supposed to be there as a sexual object for the man.
The Chicago Mercantile Exchange doesn't keep stats, but Virginia estimates that women make up less than 1% of the traders on the floor. She's the daughter of a Mexican mother and an Irish and German father. One of only two Latinas here.
You were just who I was calling.
In 1976, right out of high school, she started as a runner. She literally ran a card with trade scribbled on it from a desk to the pit. She was hooked.
I love coming to the trading floor because you have your thumb on the pulse of everything going on all the way around the world. It's exciting every day.
Exciting might be an understatement. In its heyday, in the 80s, it was an adrenaline-filled chasm packed with roaring men. A place where you could make millions of dollars or lose it all in a single day.
I watched three people absolutely fall over dead, heart attack or whatever. I've seen grown men sobbing, knowing that they had worked here their whole life and they made a mistake and they have to go home and they've lost everything.
For Virginia, who comes from a working-class background with a high school diploma, there's no other place that can offer the same upward mobility.
When I saw the first month of $20,000 or $25,000, I literally, like, fell to my knees. It was a great moment. I recognized that making that money was real freedom.
To get there, she had to go toe-to-toe with at least a dozen other traders.
Many times I went home in tears. I mean, not outwardly. Never did I do that cry on the trading floor.
I was impressed with the fact that she was able to transcend that gender situation.
That's Mark Ovacharchin. He's been a broker in the pit with Virginia since the early days.
She had the demeanor to be able to walk in and basically, you know, push around with the big boys.
To gain an advantage in the pits, it was common for trading houses to hire former basketball or football players or make traders take voice lessons. Traders say to be successful, you need to be tall, loud, or aggressive. At just 5'5", Virginia relies on the latter two.
It's about money. You cannot be weak here.
What's he bidding for?
What's that, Rich?
Bob, August 560 puts cover tight at three. What are you?
Seven and a half, 25.
Oh.
She says she faced another challenge, being the only openly gay woman on the floor.
And then when they would call me lesbian or dyke or something like that, and I said, you know, you're just jealous because my girlfriends are way hotter than yours. You know, then tell your wife to stop calling me.
3/8 bid, August put spread. I'll buy 50. I'll buy 100. 3/8 bid.
Virginia has a personal assistant, her niece, Veronica McGathy. She's sweet, just a couple years out of art school, someone who'd be easy prey for men who think it's fine to hit on women on the exchange floor. But Veronica's learned to stand up for herself. And besides,
as soon as they find out that you're related, like, most of them stop, like, just because they know, like, that they'll get given to them, you know.
From the Mexican side, and what I learned a lot from my mom, is that there really is a sense of community, you know, a sense of nurturing part of who I am, certainly as a woman, but as a Latina woman.
These days, Virginia trades in wheat options on behalf of big agricultural companies and banks. But over the last couple years, she's watched the floor empty out. Open outcry is being replaced by electronic trading.
Okay. To see the pits close and the close of an era is absolutely heartbreaking.
But electronic trading may have its advantages because it makes traders anonymous. It will no longer matter how tall, loud, or aggressive you are, or what race, gender, or sexual orientation. When Virginia looks back, she's bittersweet. Most new traders don't make it through their first year because of the stress. She's made it through 32.
The battle really was to win it on my terms.
Without compromising who she is as an openly gay woman of color.
So in the grand scheme of things, then, if I look at myself, then I'm actually very successful.
Well, it sure sounds like she's been successful. Wow, what a tough mujer. Thanks to Adriana Cargill for that piece. And next on Latino USA?
You have on one end a very affluent Mexican professional community. At the other end, you have about 1.2 million Mexicans that happens to be the poorest in Mexico.
The surprising place where Mexico's hard workers meet. But first, the tale of the radicals who became mainstream journalists. Stay with us. No se vayan.
We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening, everyone. So it's back to school, and for many that means back to work or back to the grind. But the team here at Latino USA has been working hard all summer long. So how about some post-summer love? If you like our show, just take a moment to rate and review it on iTunes. We're also taking on more ambitious stories and shows. We know you know that. But if you want to help us make that happen, just consider going to latinousa.org and clicking on the donate button. Real easy, and we appreciate it so much. Gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, with more than 25 years of Kids Count data on the well-being of America's children, providing access to national and local information, as well as state rankings. Learn more at datacenter.kidscount.org.
You might have heard us talk about the Young Lords before on our program. Now, if you're not familiar with them, they were a Puerto Rican activist group which had its heyday during the 1970s. Sometimes people describe the Young Lords as a Puerto Rican version of the Black Panthers. For some, their legacy is inspirational and impressive. The legendary New York newspaper columnist Jimmy Breslin used to joke that the Young Lords produced more great journalists than Columbia University's School of Journalism. From the start, the Young Lords just knew how to use the mass media.
If the system continues to oppress us, then all we can resort to is any method possible to achieve our liberation.
Back in 1970, Juan González was the Young Lords' self-titled Minister of Defense. Here he is on New York's lefty radio station, WBAI.
If that means bombing American hotels to get American business out of Puerto Rico, then that's what has to happen. Que viva Puerto Rico libre.
That's beautiful.
These days, González is a best-selling author and an award-winning columnist at the New York Daily News. And other former Young Lords also took what they learned from dealing with the media as activists and turned that into journalism careers. So for today's show on workaholics, John Kalish brings us this report about how some of the Lords went from working in the streets of Spanish Harlem to being the face of New York local media. And a quick note, the story contains some words that might upset some of you, so John will let you know when it's about to come up.
The Young Lords grew out of a Chicago street gang. They wore purple berets and modeled themselves after the Black Panthers. There were chapters in Philadelphia, Boston, and Newark, New Jersey, but the epicenter of the movement was in New York. Between the late 1960s and the mid-70s, the Lords mobilized thousands of people to demonstrate for Puerto Rico's independence and against police brutality.
We'd like to make it very clear that this is going to happen to any institution and any oppressed community that does not respond to the needs of the people.
The Young Lords began their push for social change by serving the community of Spanish Harlem. Their first efforts focused on sanitation.
We began with the garbage, and for 3 weeks we swept streets. Believe it or not, we were like goody-goodies, sweeping the streets all day.
That's Felipe Luciano, chairman of the Young Lords, on Pacifica radio station KPFA.
After 3 weeks, we blockaded traffic northbound and southbound, and we blocked the city up. The next Sunday we did it again. And this time the whole El Barrio joined us. Everybody, fire alarms were pulled all over El Barrio. This is just the focus on the garbage.
Another celebrated action was the hijacking of a truck used to screen for tuberculosis. The Young Lords brought it to East Harlem. When the news crews arrived, they were greeted with a made-for-TV image, the Puerto Rican flag draped across the truck.
Our first most effective organizing tool was the Puerto Rican flag. We knew the power of the flag.
Pablo Guzman was the Lord's Minister of Information.
I understood that we were bombarded with propaganda of different types all the time, and it wasn't called that. You know, it was advertising, or it was just stuff from the government that, you know, hey, we want you to know this or whatever. It was all propaganda. And I had to find a way to put out our propaganda.
They found a lot of ways to make this happen through direct action, music, a newspaper, and a radio show. Young Lords leader Juan González.
We early on began to understand the importance of the mass media in shaping people's consciousness, their understanding of the world. So I think we were appreciative of what could be done you know, if you're able to get a message across.
The young lords occupied a church building in East Harlem that they wanted to use for a clothing drive and free breakfast program. They went door to door testing children for lead poisoning. They took over a decrepit hospital in the South Bronx, spurring the city to build a new one.
We provided substantive victories for our people.
Felipe Luciano.
Lincoln Hospital, the new one. Free breakfast programs. Puerto Rican history in the schools. We fought for that. This was what we did.
Luciano was an eloquent public speaker. He also performed with the Last Poets, an African-American poetry group that's now recognized as a precursor to hip-hop. Here is Luciano reciting the poem Jíbaro. Just a warning, it contains the N-word.
Jíbaro, my pretty nigga. Father of my yearning for the soil, the land, the earth of my people. Father of the sweet smells of fruit in my mother's womb, the earth brown of my skin, the thoughts of freedom that butterfly through my insides.
The Young Lords also had a weekly newspaper and a radio show, both called Palante, which means forward.
Good evening, this is Palante, radio show of the Young Lords Organization, brought to you by the Latin Revolutionary News Service. Tonight I have with me, my name is Yoruba.
That was Pablo Guzman, the Minister of Information. He describes himself as a nerd who grew up in a South Bronx housing project and attended the elite public high school Bronx Science. In the early 1970s, Guzman served 9 months in prison for draft resistance. A few years later, he became a TV reporter.
News 2 reporter Pablo Guzman follows the trail of the money and the tapes.
Carmine Agnello may have married into the highest reaches of the family hierarchy by marrying Victoria Gotti.
Ironically, I became this kind of law enforcement beat guy and mafia guy. Who would have envisioned that? But it was because of the Young Lords that I developed those contacts. FBI agents who used to surveil us. I mean, I would get stuff from them, or Secret Service, you know.
In fact, one of the biggest exclusives in his 28-year career was an interview with a police inspector at a precinct where city cops had tortured suspects with stun guns. The inspector, it turned out, had guarded the church in East Harlem the Lords had occupied back in the day. Felipe Luciano, the Young Lords chairman, also went into broadcasting.
I vowed that if I ever got in the air, I would speak as truthfully, as honestly, as incisively as I could about our condition.
Luciano hosted a radio show called Latin Roots, which gave Tito Puente, Eddie Palmieri, and Celia Cruz their first sustained New York airplay. But he was fired for mixing political advocacy with the salsa. After that, he became a TV reporter.
I had an ideological conviction, so I went into NBC fully formed as a political being.
Luciano now runs the municipal television station in Newark, New Jersey. He says his time in the Young Lords gave him a sensibility outside the mainstream.
You're 67. Do you still consider yourself a revolutionary of sorts?
Absolutely.
Luciano and Guzman tried to affect change in the media by becoming journalists. Denise Oliver Velez did it another way. She was the first woman on the Young Lords Central Committee and also became active in the Black Panthers and the Black Filmmakers Foundation. In the late 1970s, she took a job at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, where she helped foster the expansion of public TV program for communities of color. Her main job was to run CPB's minority and women's training program.
A lot of people turn things off when it's time for the credits. I don't, because I'm still seeing people who were original recipients of training grants from our office.
The job involved visiting public radio and TV stations to check up on the trainees. One stop was in Mississippi.
We had paid for the local station to hire a Black woman as program director of the station. Show up at the station, ask to speak to her, and they said, oh, the colored girl that picks up the mail? And I was like, excuse me? The what? The colored girl that she's at the post office.
The woman's working conditions improved. Now, more than 30 years later, that woman is still working in public radio. These days, Oliver Velez lives in rural upstate New York, where she teaches college students and is a blogger for the left-of-center website Daily Kos.
It has become a vehicle for a lot of the things that I've been dedicated to all my life. I believe that you community organize as a blogger.
Of all the young lords who went on to media careers, none has had the impact of the longtime New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez. Here in the paper's city room, Gonzalez wears a conservative business suit as he sits talking to sources on the phone. His investigative reporting has won major awards, and he somehow manages to find the time to co-host the TV program Democracy Now!
Yeah, well, I still consider myself to have a revolutionary perspective and attitude to challenge those in power, try to find out what it is that's afflicting people or stories that other people aren't writing about.
Gonzalez recently exposed the library bureaucrats' lavish office renovation and efforts by private schools to reserve city parks for their exclusive use. It's an editorial focus that harkens back to one of the young lord's original demands, community control of public institutions. But the former young lords are looking forward to when Gonzalez served as president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. He got a $100,000 donation to train the next generation of Latino reporters. The money came from the young lord's former lawyer, a guy by the name of Geraldo Rivera. For Latino USA, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Tu amor es un periódico de ayer.
Thanks to John Kalish for his story. And these days, if you pick up a newspaper or watch local TV in New York City, well, there's a pretty good chance that you've come across the work of at least one of the former young lords. And that's what I love about New York, how everything is so close together that things can get very mixed up. Like if you happen to go to a high-end restaurant here, there's a good chance that you're dining among some of the wealthiest Mexicans in the world while being served by some of the poorest Mexicans. Both classes are part of the recent Mexican migration to New York City. And just like the young lords sought to create and elevate their Puerto Rican community in New York, a group of Mexican businessmen living in the city are now reaching out to other Mexicans who are more financially challenged as a way to create a sense of unity for the entire Mexican community in New York City. Our producer, Antonia Cerejido, has our story.
When Edgar Morales moved from Puebla, Mexico, to New York City, he was nervous about going to an American high school.
You know, all these movies that I used to watch in Mexico, they show that high school was some kind of prison-like place, you know, because you're the new guy, so everyone already has friends, and they will start bullying you.
Once Edgar's family settled in the Bronx, he started going to the local high school. I meet him at a playground only a couple blocks from where he used to go. Did you make a lot of friends?
Not really. I'm not very social or very good at making friends, so I just made a few of them.
Instead of focusing on friends, Edgar focused on grades. He ended up graduating at the top of his class. He wanted to go to college, but there was one thing in the way. Edgar is undocumented. So after high school, he went to work in construction with his father, until his dad stumbled across something.
He was one day reading the newspaper, and he read an article about a scholarship for undocumented students.
That scholarship was offered by the Association of Mexican Professionals and Entrepreneurs, also known as APIM. APIM is unique because it's an organization run by Mexicans for Mexicans in New York City. Thanks to APIM, today Edgar is studying computer science at the City University of New York.
I was hoping to someday work on Google or Microsoft, but that's my, like, the biggest goal.
APIM partners students like Edgar with professionals who work in the business world. And while Edgar had me meet him in a park, his mentor, Carlos Valverde, had me go someplace much higher up, literally.
So this is the 10th floor of the World Trade Center. It's the marketing center for...
Carlos is a construction manager at the World Trade Center. He lives and breathes skyscrapers. He loves his job.
You know, if it's Sunday night, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and if you actually want to go to work the next day, it means that you really love your job. So that's the Sunday test. So I passed the Sunday test.
Carlos, who's also from Mexico, sees his same drive in Edgar. Edgar says he never would have met a mentor like Carlos back in Mexico.
Where I used to live was a very poor town, so it would be very, very weird to hang out with some, you know, very respectable guy there. These are the poor people, like the low-class people. They will, like, be on a separate place of the town, and while the rich people will have their own avenue, their own streets. Like, it will be like they have even their own colony.
But in New York, things are different.
There was a very interesting situation happening in New York that only happens here and not really in any other city in the States.
Jorge Suarez is a Mexican native who came to New York City 23 years ago to work in finance. He helped found a PEM.
You have on one end a very, I would say, affluent Mexican professional community, because many of us come to work in Wall Street, to work with media companies. At the other end, you have about 1.2 million Mexicans that have migrated, coming from this area, the Mixteca, that happens to be the poorest region in Mexico.
The goal of APEM's efforts is to help poor immigrants pull themselves upward.
They're not asking for a handout. They're asking for opportunities.
Other nonprofits like APEM have started to pop up. But there's more than altruism at play here. A new immigrant community to New York, Mexicans are still trying to establish their place. And togetherness can bring power in numbers, says Jorge Suarez.
What we would like to have is a Mexican-American community that is strongly Mexican and strongly American. The mix of both makes a much stronger unit.
And that means creating a sense of Mexican pride, no matter what class someone is from. Jorge found that when he first started giving out scholarships, many of the students didn't know of any other Mexicans in the city.
So they basically had no identity. But once they start realizing that others are like them, then wonderful things start happening. You know, they start becoming much more confident. They start being much more assertive.
And that's APEM's aspiration, to play a role in creating the next powerful immigrant community.
I think this country has been made better by all these waves of migration, be it Jewish or Irish or Italian.
Someone like Edgar could be a case in point. Recently, he went to an APEM seminar where his mentor, Carlos, gave a tour of the World Trade Center.
Actually, he did a joke about me. Well, kind of a joke. I don't know how to take it. So one day in the future, maybe like 5 more years, I will have my company there and I will start hiring people and I will be one of the, you know, most important computer scientists of New York.
Who knows? Maybe it won't be a joke, but just a new chapter in the classic American immigration story.
Thanks for that report, Antonia. Antonia Cerejido is one of our producers, and that story was produced in association with Round Earth Media. Tyler Kelly co-reported the piece. When it comes to working hard, we came across a lot of people working hard together. Coming up on Latino USA, day laborers band together for protections. And next,
being successful in this industry came hand in hand with being Latin, you know, growing up, watching my parents just grind on a daily basis.
Stay with us, no se vayan.
Tú estás coqueta, yo estoy coqueto. Tú y yo hacemos un buen dueto. Tú eres una loca y yo soy un demente. Contigo me quedo hasta que se me caigan los dientes. Te tengo una propuesta sencilla. Vamos a mezclarnos como pan con mantequilla. Como refrito con guacamole bien mezclado. Como arroz con frijoles. Nosotros nacimos con las piernas sueltas. Vámonos para atrás, para los años 80. Para cuando Madonna era virgen y John Travolta en el piso daba vueltas. Un mundo de colores.
Thanks for listening to Latino USA. Now, you might be hearing this podcast on your smartphone or your computer, things that most of us, including the workaholics that we're talking about today, can't even imagine living without. Being connected to a screen all day is the new norm. So, what is all this screen time actually doing to us? NPR's Guy Raz and the team at the TED Radio Hour are asking those same questions in a special two-part episode all about our relationships with our screens, how they're changing the way we interact with others, and how they'll be shaping our future. Listen to Screen Time on the TED Radio Hour beginning September 11th. Find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Hoy no quiero trabajar. Hoy no me voy a levantar. Hoy no seré parte del esquema. Y voy a mandar pa'l diablo al jodido sistema. Llamaré al trabajo y diré que tengo diarrea. O que a mi hermano lo agarra una gonorrea. Hoy quiero que el mundo sea más sencillo. Empezaré por durar todo el día en pantaloncillo. Me voy a preparar un sándwich de 19 piezas. Con todos los carbohidratos y toda la grasa que le quepan. Me voy a quedar durmiendo como por 15 horas. Y en vez de agua, un camión de Coca-Cola. Hoy no quiero trabajar.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, an online resource dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students with information and strategies about what works in K-12 education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. Learn more at knightfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So you know how celebrities always look put together? Like they never need to carry a bag or make a dentist appointment or ride the subway? Well, the glitz and glam of a pop star like Rihanna, it might look effortless, but no matter how hard she works, you know she can't do it alone. Because behind every superstar, there's a team of tireless stylists, producers, and assistants. People like Jennifer Rosales and Patty Rodriguez, who are two high-powered Latinas working behind the scenes in the entertainment business. Patty is senior producer for Ryan Seacrest's morning radio show.
It's hard to explain what a producer does. It's almost like being a stay-at-home mom. You kind of do everything.
Patty also started the online campaign that led to MAC Cosmetics, creating a makeup line inspired by the late Tejana superstar Selena. Thank you, Patty! As if that's not enough, Barnes & Noble picked up her series of bilingual children's books. And Jen?
Jen, you have the coolest job in the world.
Yeah, you know, I'm very blessed where I'm at. You know, I work for one of the hardest working women out there, Rihanna.
Jen is Rihanna's personal assistant. Seriously. Now, Jen and Patty first met 10 years ago when they were slugging it out as members of the street team for the radio station Kiss FM in L.A. Back then, they were both in their early 20s.
To this day, Kiss FM was probably one of my favorite jobs. I had a blast.
It's the coolest job someone who's in their early 20s.
Yeah, it's perfect.
The both of them moved up from being promoters on the street to then going behind the scenes, but their jobs have never been boring.
With all the glitz and the glamour comes a lot of sacrifice and hard work. People think that it's just, you know, the champagne, but it's not. You miss a lot of personal life, a lot of weddings, a lot of birthdays, a lot of, you know.
You travel a lot with her.
Yeah, I do. I travel, you know, I'm probably home maybe 2 or 3 months out of the entire year, you know, spread throughout the year. But it's all worth it, you know. I've been able to provide for my family, you know, due to this job.
And there's no better feeling, right?
Yeah, like that's all I ever wanted, you know. Mm-hmm. Before I buy the yachts and the houses, I'm going to take care of my family. So right now I'm able to do that. And, you know, it's a blessing. And it all comes from, you know, the hard work. And, you know, I'll continue on until the wheels fall off. What about you, Patty?
Well, I don't travel as much, but I do have a pretty cool job. I work as a senior producer for Ryan Seacrest. I can't explain it other than say that you have to always keep your eyes open to everything that's happening around you, around the world. Anticipate the trends, be on top of what's cool, what's happening. always being online on social media, reading what people are saying, what they're thinking, what are they feeling, and get all that and try to package it and put a show together, a fun show, a show that's relatable.
It's a great show. I still listen to it.
It's fun. I've been doing it for, 10 years now, and it's still exciting every morning.
Yeah, something new, different. Yeah, you know, that's the one thing about me, too. You know, my office is sometimes a beach, sometimes, Paris. Sometimes.
You cannot be bored.
It's a work ethic that both of them learn from their families.
My family is from Jalisco, Mexico.
Yeah, my dad is from Michoacán, Mexico, and my mom is Costa Rican. Well, they both came here with no one, no money, nothing, didn't know the language, nothing.
Did they cross the border?
My dad crossed the border. They both did, actually. Yeah. My dad did it the old school coyote style.
Yeah.
You know, through gutters and all that kind of stuff.
The desert.
Yep. And my mom dressed up like a white woman. Did her hair all big, threw on like this big, like what she thought at the time was this like fabulous coat and high heels, and did her hair and makeup, and then just walked right. You know how you could walk across the border instead of driving?
Yeah.
So she did the walking.
No.
And at the time, they didn't check every passport. It was just random, like...
Selection.
Mm-hmm. And she thought, I'm going to dress up like a rich white woman and they won't stop me. And that's exactly what happened.
No.
Mm-hmm.
That's an epic story.
Yeah. What does Latina mean to you, Patty?
Oh, I think it's...
On a day-to-day.
Honestly, it's in my blood. I feel it. I'm very passionate about it. And now as a mother... I want to ensure my son also feels the same way. Because as generations continue to grow, you could kind of slowly lose it.
Right.
And I don't want my son to lose that at all.
100%. I mean, being successful in this industry came hand in hand with being Latin. You know, growing up, watching my parents just grind on a daily basis. You know, from morning to night, every day, no days off. You know, the one thing I always knew was, you know, work hard. Work hard and you'll succeed. And my parents came with nothing and now they live a beautiful life. And it was all from hard work. And that came from our culture. It came from being Latins. There's not too many lazy Latins out there. There's a few, but not a lot.
You know, to me, it still feels like a dream. It's hard to imagine that. You know, here's this little Mexican-American girl whose parents came here to this country with nothing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
yeah.
was able to look outside the box and go for it. And I find it very hard for me still to this day. I still feel like it's a dream and it's surreal.
Yeah.
And I don't take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I have the opportunity to talk to other Latina young girls... You know, I tell them it's possible. It's just, you just got to do it. You just got to jump. Close your eyes and jump.
When I said, all right, I'm going to do music, there was never a fear behind it. You know, like most, I feel like a lot of people don't do it because they're scared that they might not make it, that, you know, it'll be hard, whatever, you know, whatever their inhibitions are. But, you know, part of why I just... went and did it and said, I'm going to do it and succeeded was, you know, my parents were very much, you know, do whatever you want. We got your back regardless. And I knew that if I failed or if, you know, I couldn't anymore, I could just come back home. And
that's life, the beauty of a Latino parents,
would
right?
still be, you know, bliss. So I was able with that confidence that they instilled in me and mm-hmm. to know that they were my little safety net. Because, you know, you could be 45 still living at home and it's no big deal.
Oh, no. They don't want you to leave.
Yeah, I just left. I officially left my home because I got married in April. I officially left my home at 34. And my mother was still to date. She just called me on my way over here, actually, and is the biggest wreck. Like, she just cannot.
She wants you home.
She can't survive. I'm like, pull yourself together, mother, please. She just can't, but...
She's like, bring your husband with you.
Yeah, what?
You know, we'll make an extra room in the back.
Yes.
We'll convert the garage.
Please. And the dog, everything. Bring everyone. But, you know, that's why I was able to go and be and do, because that's just the culture.
The voices of good friends Jennifer Rosales and Patty Rodriguez. Jen is a personal assistant to Rihanna, and Patty Rodriguez is the senior producer of iHeartMedia's On Air with Ryan Seacrest. I related to what the women said about their families, because workaholic or not, having a support system is important. And so is having people in your corner who understand the actual rules and laws that apply to working. Jornaleros, or day laborers, working in the informal economy, can often be cheated out of their pay or face really dangerous working conditions. When that happens, oftentimes they don't know what to do. So in California, some workers are joining together to keep themselves safe. Marissa Ortega-Welch brings us this story from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Felix Mendoza has been standing on a corner of 12th Street in Oakland all morning. Mendoza waits here with a few other guys 2 or 3 days a week, looking for work. He came to the U.S. from Guatemala 4 years ago. If he's lucky, maybe a homeowner who needs help moving will drive by and pick him up. Or maybe it will be a contractor who needs a few more guys for a construction job. Different people hire us, he says. Sometimes they pay well and sometimes they don't. But what else can you do, he says, other than accept it? Romilio Aldana has asked himself the same question. Up in the Oakland Hills, he and three other day laborers are already at work, moving heavy furniture up the stairs into a couple's condo. I used to wait for work on the street corners, Aldana says. Some days I found work and some days I didn't. Aldana's from Guatemala, but he's been in the U.S. for 31 years. He's seen his share of problems. One time, he and three other workers got hired to clean a football stadium. The employer collected all of their belongings in a bag, saying it was for safety reasons. It turned out to be a scam. The guy left, he says. He took everything we had. He got my phone and my wallet, which had cash for my last 2 days of work that I needed to pay the rent. Another time, Aldana was hired to do a job clearing bushes. I went up into the Oakland Hills where there's a lot of poison oak, he says, and I got it all over my neck and arms. He didn't recognize the plant, and he says his employer didn't warn him. He couldn't afford medicine, so he treated it with vinegar. That got rid of the infection, but burned his skin. Aldana's stories are not uncommon. Advocates say day laborers are more likely to get injured on the job than permanent employees.
Most employers do not provide them with the health and safety equipment, or most workers are not trained to do the jobs.
That's Gabriela Galicia, the day labor organizer for the Oakland Workers Collective.
We also found out that a lot of the day laborers felt, because of their status sometimes, that workers' rights laws do not apply to them.
But they do apply. Day laborers are covered under federal occupational health and safety laws, no matter what their immigration status is. But because many don't speak English or are undocumented, they rarely report abuses to the government. Or they figure if they're only on a job for a day, it's not worth it. So that's where the Oakland Workers Collective comes in. It started in 2012 as a way for laborers to protect themselves. They set up a central phone number people can call if they want to hire someone. Romilio Aldana joined 2 years ago.
Aquí en la colectiva, pues siento que nos va mejor. Van ellos con más confianza con uno.
Here in the collective, he says, I feel like we're better off. The employers have to leave their name and address on file, so they're less likely to take advantage of us. Weekly meetings give workers a chance to brainstorm how to handle tough situations, like asking for a fair wage or for safety gear. Galicia, the organizer, says over time, she's seen more workers speak up for themselves.
Even though they know that they may need a job to pay their rent that month, or, you know, they need to pay a bill, some of them have walked away. And I think that that's a very big step where people can say, you know what, this is not okay. You're violating my rights, and I don't feel like I need to do this job.
I think this is a job. Great Day Labor Center, this is Oliver speaking. How may I help you?
An hour and a half north of Oakland, the Grayton Day Labor Center is buzzing with life. First priority for a job goes to those who haven't worked in a while. The rest are picked by a raffle. It's a system the workers came up with themselves. They can also learn about federal safety standards and rights here. Jesus Guzman, the program manager, models his classes on popular education, a teaching method from Latin America that values everyone's personal experience.
You say no one knows everything and no one knows nothing, but we all know something and we learn from one another.
Today, they're talking about a proposal to raise the hourly wage for moving jobs from $15 to $18 an hour. Jose Vega Herrera is their elected leader. If we're going to ask for a higher wage, he says, we have to train ourselves to treat our customers well. Another worker agrees, we have to do good, safe work. Yes, Herrera says, safe for you, safe for the client. The next morning, back in Oakland, a group of day laborers are hanging out on the street by Home Depot. Some of them are undocumented, so they don't give me their last names, but they are willing to talk. We're working, says Luis, who's from Honduras, at $15 an hour for 8 hours, $120 minimum. There are some who want to hire us for 10, he says, but we won't go for 10. Why, I ask. Out of necessity, Fabricio says. I ask them if they're part of the Oakland Workers Collective. No, Fabricio says, I'm part of this group of day laborers. But, he says, they do know about the collective and the power of working together. So even though they aren't members, they've organized themselves just the same.
Our thanks to Marissa Ortega Welch for that story. To learn more about these day laborer collectives, just check out our website at latinousa.org. Now, at the top of the show, we heard from Adolfo Mendez, the workaholic, or as he says, the working holic, who owns 2 taquerias and a grocery store in Upper Michigan. He told our producer, Antonia Cerejido, about all the things he's given up to maintain his stores. Exercise, friends. He's even upset his mom in that way moms can sometimes get upset because he's given up on having kids.
Does your mom ever get mad at you and go, where are the grandkids? Quiero nietos. ¿No te dice eso?
Yes. My mom, she asking to me what happened. I said, why you need more? I want to see one for you. Okay, I'll buy soon one and play with that.
Yeah, trying to make amends or apologizing, that's one of the things I do with my kids a lot. Apologize for not being around because I have to work or because I'm traveling. The thing is, if you're a workaholic con pasión, then these sacrifices might be worth it. I mean, just listen to these wise words or sabiduría from Adolfo.
And the most important is how you feel. If you feel happy with that, that's okay. That's your life.
Maybe being a workaholic is only a problem if you don't feel good about what you do. Because I've been called a workaholic and I used to hate it. But the thing is, if I think about it in these terms, as being someone who loves their work passionately, feels good doing it, then I don't mind the label so much because I love my job. I love my staff. I love my work. So go ahead. Call me a workingholic all you want. And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Julia Hsu is our production assistant. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. And this batch of workaholics says goodbye this week to our producer, Camilo Vargas, who decided that Colombia needed him back home. Many of you remember Camilo's story about saying goodbye to his grandmother in Bogotá for the wonderful Abuelos Hour he produced. That story made all of us here at Latino USA cry. And the truth is, when we found out that Camilo was going back to Bogotá, we all cried again. Thank you, Camilo, for your journalist's heart and your Latin American soul. Ya te extrañamos. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
My favorite hobby is watching people fall.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And Americans for the Arts, for more than half a century committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education in partnership with local, state, and national leaders. Learn more at americansforthearts.org. This is NPR.